Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really looking forward to talking with an absolutely dynamic individual, Martin Leitz. He's the founder and CEO of Trendwolves, a research and marketing agency with a specific focus on European youth. He's an absolute expert in translating trends into products, strategies, campaigns, and future brand value. He is also the author of the newly published Generation Z Alpha, which we'll be talking about in a while. He is also an advisor on youth culture to Sparks and Honey in New York and is the ex-president of La Futura Global Trend Network. So, Martin, hi, and how are you?
I'm doing very fine, Sean. I'm very pleased to be in your podcast.
Very, very kind. So, go on, Martin, before we go any further, where are you today?
I'm in my hometown. I'm living in the beautiful Bruges in Belgium, which they call the Venice of the North. And next to my research activities and my company, I run a small hotel over there together with my wife and my children.
Fantastic. Very, very envious of all of that. So, Martin, the new book sounds absolutely fantastic, and I've been reading it. But before we perhaps get to that, I think it'd be really interesting just to go through your background, how you got to set up Trendwolves, which I know, you know, really renowned, really, really dynamic agency. So go on then. The usual thing, was it a very straight road, or was it a very windy path that led you to where you are now?
But, you know, it's an interesting question. I think there was never a plan starting Trendwolves. Just a bit about my background. I started to become a teacher and then journalism. I was journalist for a while. And then I got in social cultural work, or how it's called in Belgium. I was like leading an organization that first was like taking care of elderly people. Which sounds very funny now if I think about it. But I was leading like an organization that was working with elderly people, like their activities and making sure they did dynamic things. It was my first job. And then after a couple of years, I was asked within that big organization, which was like a health fund, one of the biggest health funds in Belgium, to lead their youth department. So I was working on health education, health promotion towards youngsters. I was always fascinated by how to reach youngsters in a dynamic way. So I did in that time some very interesting and crazy things. So we promoted ourselves as being a health communicator towards all youngsters. So we had to bring topics like don't use drugs, have safe sex, all these kind of things. So all the things in a way youngsters don't want to hear. But we invented ways in reaching them that were quite innovative at that time. Running a youth magazine at that time that was quite popular in Belgium, which was called Zap. And, you know, I learned at that time that if you want to target young people, you have to go where they are. So if I wanted to bring my message to them, It's not that I was sitting on a ton of money, you know, so I had to be inventive. So what we did, for example, was we knew where youngsters were in Belgium. They were buying fries on the Friday evening, Saturday evening, and you had their waiting moments. So I made an agreement with the fruit shops in Belgium and their organization to give them advertisement in, and you know, then they were willing to put my magazine on their desk. So it appeared that after a while it was huge. It was very successful. We did actions towards festivals where we launched promotion on safe sex using campaigns like the Belgian Popline, which was a cooperation with the music industry, just like having, you know, packing a condom into an image or a package of an artist. It became a line. We worked with it with international artists after a while, you know, and slowly I started to realize that, you know, this was my thing, you know, working together with youngsters, you know, reaching them in the correct way. So it, for me, it was a very good learning school. I did that for 7 years. And at the same time, I was elected as president of the National Youth Agency here in Belgium. So it meant that I had to negotiate the cultural agreements within Flanders and all countries worldwide. So in that period, I was constantly traveling, talking with young people all over the world, being especially talking with people that were leading their the youth councils of that country, from South Africa till Russia, let's say. And after a while, I thought, you know, I should do something with that, you know, not only with the learnings I had, but with the network I've built. I'm talking pre, you know, in the beginning of the internet age, let's say, like that.
Yeah.
So it was a very interesting time. I'm talking about the beginning of the millennium. So, you know, it was a very interesting time. And yeah, from there on, you know, I realized that, you know, working with young people always gave me a very good, you know, feeling about, how to say, I could not describe it at that time, but I realized that there was there something, you know, if you work together with young people, how they look to the future, the ambitions they have. And I wanted to decode that a bit, you know, what makes younger generations driving innovation. And this was in a way the fundament for my company, Trendfuls. While we are like working on trend research with a focus on youth culture, as we believe that it all starts there, you know, that a lot of things happening within that younger generations, and as they're very aspirational for older generations, it's important to decode their, you know, to study subcultures, to which I call like, they're almost like engines of social cohesion, you know, and it's like what I, you know, what we really like to study, what's happening there, what about their, what's about their values, about their looks, about their skills, about their codes. If you can define this in a very well way, you have a lot of information you can use to set up campaigns, to set up stories, to set up projects together with clients. So, you know, to be honest, John, there was not a real plan. There was just a lot of passion for what we're doing, and interest. And yeah, you know, it's, I think what the people at Trendfuls and what we like to do is not only like doing the research, but actually making it alive as well. You know, we use insights to create impact and to work together with clients on, you know, on projects, on new campaigns, on, you know, on making the difference. This is what we like to do.
Mm. And I know that in terms of sort of macro thinking on that, one of the people that you quote in the book is the French philosopher Auguste Comte, you know, who famously said, you know, generational change is the key driver of the speed of societal change.
Yeah. I fully agree. And, you know, the interesting thing is that now we have this period again. You know, when you talk about generations and values, they always have like the discussion, you know, if generational thinking is a good, let's say, framework to discuss things, because then you get like remarks from people saying after a while, yeah, but you know, it's if you look at values, they're a lot as much as, how to say, differences within a generation as in between generations, you know. So, you know, these are the kind of remarks which is true, you know, because when you look at generations, you know, values, when it's about values, values you get from your parents at the table, I always say, you know, you get values from, you know, being at home, and they got it from their parents. And the interesting thing is, when you look at studies about generational thinking and generational frameworks, the interesting thing about it is that you had a study, it ended in 2022, over 12 years, that actually showed very precise that yes, there's a difference in values in between generations, where like younger people tend to be more opener older people tend to be more conservative.
Yeah,
they really showed it in that study. And it was like a longitudinal research over 12 years. And they showed as well that values can change. You know, people can change their value. You know, when you have like migration or terroristic attacks or, I don't know, climate issues and so on, or some experience that people have, it impacts their values. And at the other hand, you know, when you then look at the same period at research from in America, for example, you can read that it's like nonsense, you know. So it's with everything like that. You always have like these T's and these anti-T's, which I like is important as well. It's about, you know, creating this balance, and you have to have a look at both sides. But the thing, you know, with generational thinking and generational research is that, of course, you do it to unite people and not to divide people. And when you look at like these social scientists like Howe, like Karl Mayne in Holland, that were working on this generational frameworks, they never had the intention to, how to say, to separate people, you know. They just wanted to understand what is driving generations, what are the forces behind it. And, you know, I'm very keen of that idea. I think it's an important way of looking at society, understanding generations, because, you know, when there are differences, yes, you know, you can find ways to unite them again. So I think this is from major importance. But I'm personally believe very strongly that one of the biggest drivers within generations is technology. You know, it's through the lens of technology that people experience events and things that happen, and even more than the events on itself, how they perceive the information, how they look at information.
Yeah,
technology makes it so important. And that's why, you know, I called that generation, which I'm describing now, Generation Alpha, as a kind of micro generation in between generations, as they're influenced by the virtual life, you know.
Yeah.
So they were raised in an early, they were raised in a period during the pandemic. My target group there was 10 till 14 years old. Let's say it's in a period where you're like in an early development stage and you're very open to a lot of things.
Yeah.
You're very adaptive to everything what's happening around you. And what you saw that, you know, children were still stuck at home. Yes, so there was a lot of uncertainty, like uncertainty in the world. There was uncertainty with their parents because there was financial uncertainty. Nobody knew where to go to. You had like this whole this conflict on information as well. Like, is government doing well? So you had a lot of uncertainties at that time. At the other hand, suddenly they were stuck behind screens. I think we accelerated during the pandemic, MAL 5, MAL 7. And suddenly, you know, they got lessons from, you know, from behind their screens, which was like different than before. Suddenly their parents were working from home behind screens. So a lot of things happened. And the most important thing is that if you look at it, that, you know, for their social interaction, they were pushed into these virtual worlds like Minecraft and Roblox to communicate with their friends. And, you know, it's such interesting thing, you know, because they look at this reality as a reality that is normal for them. It's you know, it's we that are a bit, you know, older that look at this as a different reality. But, you know, they're called as well the virtual natives, you know, and I think it's the right wording as well. You know, I call them Zalpha, but I think virtual native is a very good description of yep. that age group while they're really, you know, they're in that virtual worlds. And, you know, it's so interesting, you know, when you study the phenomena that how they interact there, how they look at realities. There's an interesting story always about the word I use, which I use in my presentations as well, with Keanu Reeves. And he's telling a story that he met a director, and the director had two children. You know, they were like in between, I think, 10 and 12 years old, something like that. And they didn't see the movie, The Matrix. And, you know, so Keanu is talking about the Matrix and saying, you know, he's explaining that it's about a guy and he lives in a virtual world. And after a while, you know, in the Matrix, he discovers there's a real world outside. And so he's explaining this story. And the girl from 11 says to him, yeah, but okay, that I don't care. And he says, what, you don't care if it's real or not real? And she says, no. You know, so what I learned from that is that, you know, we make the difference in realities. We, for, you know, when I look at, in, when you studied like this age group, the thing is that for them, it's reality. Yes. And it's interesting to see how they approach this reality. If you see the difference, for example, in between Gen Z and Gen Z, Gen Alpha, which I describe in Alpha. Yep. If you look at them, you know, when you had Gen Z, they were like saying yes, no, like in this games and in this surrounding.
Yep.
It should look like the real world. Yes. When you look at Zalpha and Alpha for the moment, for them, they have something, you know, the real world should look like the virtual world because it's like so good already. You know, so this is the big difference in between. You know, when they meet an influencer in Roblox, they really meet him. They really talked with him. Yes. So it's not a separation there. And, you know, for me, this was not the reason to write my book. The reason, well, you know, I was explaining that the trend was we do a lot of research and campaigns on a lot of things with partners worldwide. But one of the things that stuck me was the fact that my daughter, at that time, my daughter was 8, and she asked me to go to Legoland in London one morning at the breakfast table. And I said to her, yes, why, you know, why Legoland in London? And she said, yes, my friend Max told me that it's so cool over there. And I said, do you have a friend which is called Max? And it appeared to be a kidfluencer. You know, Max and Katie are like kidfluencers that are doing what children are doing. So they're, you know, they're playing with slime and marbles, and they're opening and packaging toys, and they're making movies. They're going to these playgrounds and to these big parks and so on. And then suddenly it it became clear to me. Of course, you know, I was always working on Gen Z and campaigns, that world is changing so drastically that influencers already approach kids as well at such young age. And it was for me clear that, you know, with my experience on youth marketing communication research, that it would be good to write a book about the topic, on, you know, the very interesting things that are happening with this younger generation, which is one of the biggest generations, of course, well educated. And what I always say, the impact of the iPad is so big for that generation. Why, you know, when you look at Steve Jobs, that was bringing the iPad in, I think it was 1995, if I'm correct. I'm not sure in which year it was. In 2010, it was around that period. And the thing was that, you know, in their hardware cycle, the thing was that he brought the iPad. And I think a lot of parents at that time thought, you know, this is an interesting educational tool for my children. And, you know, what you saw at that moment is that children massively became to go online. Every second, two children go online for the very first time. It's you know, it's crazy, you know. 40% of the new internet users are children. So, you know, it's so huge, it's so big. And there are a lot of questions on ethically, questions on advertising, on, you know, on protection of children, because of course the internet was initially not made for children, as we all know. Yeah. So I think it's important to be alert there. And these were all the kind of reasons why I started decided to write the book on Generations Alpha.
Mm. It's so interesting. That point about generational research, I mean, there's a lot of talk in sort of, you know, the world of advertising about, let's say, sort of work that was put out last year by the Pew Research Center in the US, you know, you'd be completely familiar with. And they're saying, you know, the question isn't whether young adults today or kids are different from people who are older than today. The question is whether young people today are different from young people at some specific point in the past. And I think that fascinating point you're making there is about, apart from anything else, one of the crucial issues that has so impacted them as has been, as you're saying, just the impact of the effect of technology and the effect of it, crucially, the pandemic and what it did to that particular cohort or subsect of a generation. So that issue about, as you put it, Generation Z Alpha is amazing. Meanwhile, you're also quoting, talking about influencers there, some are fairly influential, to put it mildly, who famously said the children, love luxury, they have bad manners, they show disrespect for elders, and they love gossip in place of activity. So true, and it wasn't said last week, it was said by Socrates 400 BCE. So there we go, some things don't change.
No, things don't change. And, you know, the interesting, just to come back to what you said on if you know, let's say that the world became much more complex. We all, you know, it's not something new I'm saying right now, but technology as a driver, cultural driver, it's, we are culture, you know, we make technology. And it means that, you know, the lens through which we experience things is getting bigger. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't
say
if it's good or bad, but the only thing I know that a 10-year-old from just behind the Second World War, or, you know, in the 60s, had a much smaller worldview than children today. And the impact of it is huge, Sean. You know, we're always talking about what is changing. You know, actually what is changing is, for example, when you look at Roblox, that children from an age group are playing in 180 countries together, and that Roblox is investing in translation technology, instant translation technology, just to make sure that these children can play together.
Yeah. Yes.
What does it mean? Because this is the fundamental of trend tools. You know, what does this mean for the future?
Yeah.
It means that for brands, for companies, for example, the market is getting much bigger. Yes.
Yeah.
And if AI is useful in this is a way I think that immediately translation, you see it, LinkedIn is using it as well already.
Yeah.
You understand what I mean? You know, why do we look at rentals at youth culture? Because it's an inspiration source for what will happen in the next 5 to 10 years. You know, if we all fond of, you know, children, youngsters are fond of TikTok and the social videos, and you can be fond of it or not. But what I'm quite sure about, if our corporate training videos will be used on TikTok, it's because it started at, amongst young people, you know. So we're wearing all jeans because it started with youngsters, you know. So they're very aspirational. Their behavior is very aspirational. And it's good to look back, to study what they're doing, just to see the impact. You know, I can give you tons of examples of things we described in the past on how we saw that young people, for example, were like ignoring ownership and went to usership already 10 years ago. You know, we were describing such kind of things.
Yeah,
and now,
yeah.
You know, now it's more common, you know, now it's more okay, you know, but it's about fundamental social behavior, and you can decode it more in youth culture. Although I have to say there as well, the impact of technology is very big, because why they started to do it? Because you had the social networks that made it possible to do it. You know,
yeah.
You had the LimeWires at that time, you know, where you could like share content and share music and videos at that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can give you tons of examples of how it went in the past and how it's like still evolving and why it's so interesting to study youth culture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In terms of the book itself, you know, Generation Z Alpha, connecting with the next micro generation, it'd be really interesting perhaps just to ask you about some of the really specific points in there that really, mm-hmm. really jumped mm-hmm. out to me. The benefits of boredom and brain development in the digital age. So go on there. Mm-hmm. Just talk a bit about that.
But I think there are different angles on that. But I think that boredom, you know, the thing is, of course, you know, technology has like its benefits, but it has like its challenges as well, you know. And the thing is that, first of all, you see, again, when I go back to technology, when I have a look at it, I see that technology enables the creativity amongst young people. You know, this is definitely correct. You know, they never studied, you know, when you look at children today, they never studied to become a film editor, for example. But what they do, they download CapCut, for example, which is an app that is like, you know, in a moment, instantly downloading movies, and you can remake them. Yeah, you put some wordings on it, one more songs, and you post them online immediately again. They never studied to become like a designer. Yes, but they have Canva, you know, so they have tools that enable their creativity, which is important. At the other hand, you know, what worries me a bit is, of course, that the time spent online is proved that it has an impact on a lot of things. For example, you know, it's proved that the use of social media and the use of social videos, for example, like the success of social videos like TikTok and as well on Instagram and so on, makes it youngsters are losing a skill like empathy, which it's to be scared about, because they see a lot of things passing on their screen and they don't have any emotion anymore with it, because it's just like everything is a movie, you know.
Yeah.
Everything is like a video. So this is what worries me. I think we're still searching in a lot of things we're doing to balance, you know. I often call it like digital balance. Nobody teaches how to run this digital age and how to deal with it. Our parents did. You know, we as parents have issues as well in controlling our children and the time they use online.
And then I think what is fascinating to link to exactly that point is, so on one level, one has the well-documented or certainly widely covered by the media perspective of concerns over empathy, particularly mm-hmm. with regards to gaming. Meanwhile, as you point out, one of the characteristics of this generation is they're the most diverse and inclusive cohort ever. So,
Yeah. You have always T's and anti-T's, of course, Sean. And one of the things, and, you know, you have different angles, you know. It's very interesting what you're saying. You know, if you look at Gen Z, it's, you know, it we should honor Gen Z that they put, you know, mental well-being high on the agenda.
Yeah.
And that they're so open about it. And, you know, it's my gut feeling, and I think that there's a lot of research done already about it, that mental well-being has a lot of stuff to do since social media arrived. I'm definitely not saying that everything is bad on social media, definitely not. But I often have the feeling that we're not connecting with each other, but with the internet, you know, if you understand what I mean. We're not connecting with each other, but with the internet. So we all do our best to shout out loud to everybody, you know, to make sure that we're seen, and capture people and get their attention. But we don't communicate with each other through social networks. You know, it's a pity. And it means that you have a lot of things that are like happening, that are like bad things. You know, the confidence amongst youngsters is going down. It's really proven. We did a big research on self-confidence, the confidence gap, the so-called confidence gap amongst young girls. We did a research in Belgium that showed very much that the impact of social media has a big influence on confidence. So from the age of 14, you see really that the confidence is much lower than towards the boys. And it has a huge impact because, you know, when you continue researching, then you see, for example, that it influenced their choices, their study choices in not studying STEM, for example. Later on, when they go to work, not to ask for a job or to a higher salary or, you know, this kind of thing. So the impact of such kind of things is huge. And, we're living in challenging times, and I think I think I have so much respect for everybody working on the future because everybody brings narratives. Stories in their ways. And I think it's important. I think even when you agree or you don't agree, I think it's important that we all bring these stories out. I see that it has it's much more popular, you know, after pandemic, and everybody's busy with futures, which I think is amazing. Mm-hmm. I think we all have to bring stories and stories alive and let people think about futures, because working on futures, it's a positive thing, and I like to do it. You know, it's not, if you approach it at least in a positive way. So
It's interesting. I think making Issy just now about particularly the point about confidence. I remember, it's a huge amount of talk about this particular subject. One sort of talk that really jumped out to me a few months ago when I was speaking at the World Retail Congress in Barcelona. Day one, Scott Galloway gave a very good keynote on day one, and he basically put TikTok as center stage in being public enemy number one. I mean, literally, he was absolutely going for it, particularly from the point of view of its hugely detrimental impact from his point of view on teenage girls and particularly of the sort of cohort you're talking about.
I cannot disagree on that. You know, in the studies we did as well, we see it as well. Self-image. You know, we're not made as well to constantly watch ourselves in on a screen, for example, but, you know, it has a bigger impact on girls than on boys. And, you know, I think the results are now already to be seen. You know, you have much more youngsters. You know, there was a study here in Belgium or on Belgium level where more than 50% of the youngsters said that they were lonely, feeling lonely. So it's not because you have the feeling. You know, it's like fake connection. You know, it's like it's not real. It's not a real connection you have. And especially now in an age where, you know, the social control falls away, you know, when children and youngsters, they go to school, they still have like this, you know, interaction, but there comes a moment after they've done studying often that they really fell into a hole. You know, you really like, you know, we often visit to see trends as well and tendencies to Southeast, you know, about the impact of K-pop and G-pop.
Yep.
But there you have like this phenomena, like the hikikomori, you know, like young people that are really already more than 1 year stuck at home, almost living their whole life behind screens. And they were, they really have to send, you know, social workers to get them out of their loneliness. So
yeah,
it's a challenge, let's say like that. But yeah, of course, not everybody's like this, but you know, it's something we have to be aware of.
And on that, I mean, I remember a while ago, I think Sarchis did a very interesting study into this, and they were looking at, you know, the real connectors, something which you were just mentioning. So they were talking about, you know, key themes like loneliness, isolation, escapism, and boredom. So one of the points you look at in chapter four is the metaverse. So go on then. People seem to have a very, very diverse perspectives on the metaverse or the metaverses. So go on then. Where are you coming at that issue?
Well, you know, the thing was that, you know, when the metaverse was hugely, let's say, on top of the agenda everywhere, because investors were following, you know, that topic as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Is, you know, for me, it was always clear that, you know, that, you know, what I strongly believe, and this is a bit my thesis, is that, you know, if you look at Zalfa, they're raised with virtual worlds, you know, they're raised with Zipito, they're raised with Minecraft, with Spatial, you know, all these worlds. Fortnite, for example, is a good example as well. So they have expectation. I believe that the metaverse will have his role to play. But when Zalfas are getting young consumers, so within here and 5 to 10 years, let's say like this, because of the influence metaverses and like Roblox and these game surroundings had in their early childhood. And that's why I think it will come back, you know, it will come back in a better way. I think it was very early stage. And it fitted perfectly in a time frame where everybody was stuck at home, you know. So it really had the right, let's say, circumstances to become a hype. Yes, because everybody was stuck at home. Although, you know, a lot of criticism was there already too. I think everybody knew that. I think we all realized that it has a lot of potential. It has potential, not, let's say, I think it has a lot of potential in an educational level, on a medical level, in training level, this kind of things. I was reading some studies a while ago on the impact it has, it can have on retail, while youngsters anyway are like keen again to go to the shopping experience, like the real experience, but they need the add-ons, they need the gameplay in shopping stores and shopping malls that they're used to see in this virtual world. So you need to go to like a combination of both worlds in a way. The whole omni-channel strategy for retail, you know, we were doing a lot of stuff for retail as well. And when you go, for example, I don't know, Sean, if you ever had the opportunity to go, for example, to Seoul or to Tokyo, especially Seoul. Yeah, especially Seoul, you know, when you see there how these both worlds are like blurring in retail experiences, it's completely over the top. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
You see virtual people talking with each other in stores. You have like these experiences there that are like amazing. I wanted to use a word that actually not work, but it's really impressive.
Yeah, yeah. I'm aware, unfortunately, of time. I think the last sort of actually big subject I'd like you to talk about would be this. Ayoub Fakhridi, the head of UNIT at the European Parliament, talking about the book, says that Martin, that's you, deftly captures different younger generation spirits, charting a future where technology serves as both a challenge as a catalyst for profound social transformation. And one of the key things I think that really leaps out here in terms of the points you're making about what is it that is genuinely different that has impacted both the generation and the sub cohort within it that simply wasn't on the table about only a decade ago. And I'm personally into this subject. I mean, I wrote about it in my first book, but this issue about data privacy. So people weren't talking about data privacy until a decade ago because it wasn't a thing. And yet obviously now it's a massive thing that I know you have a real point of view on because ethics very much drives your perspective. So go on then.
Thank you for asking me this because it's really something that is it's very important for me as I think that, you know, just to give you one example, you know, one of the things you see that, you know, the parents of Alpha and Zalphas, of course, we call them Gen Y, call them millennials, are raised in a society with social networks. Like Facebook was coming up, so they were like compulsive sharing everything they have. So they have this attitude very deeply, which is logical. As I said, you know, the impact of technology on how we look at events and things that are happening. So it's in their DNA. It's in the DNA of that generation. But what you see as well is how they often compulsive share, you know, like images from their children. You know, children are often not born yet, but they're already online, you know, as parents are like sharing, you know, the X-ray or the pictures they got from the gynecologist. So you know, the thing is that the whole, what they call Sharon thing, for example, the impact it has is that I'm sure you know as well what is happening with data farming and how these big companies are earning tons of money on data. Sure. And, you know, I saw a study in the UK which was saying that by the age of 12, there are 70,000 data points gathered from one person, which is huge. I know, you know, Barclays, you know, predicted that by 2030, there will be millions of cases of identity theft and online fraud. And it all happens, it all starts with sharing too much information. For example, about your children, you know, about this kind of topics. So I think that protecting the privacy of an individual and making sure that you can own your own data, which is a very important thing, you know, own your own data because it's your data, is a challenge towards the future. I know a couple of companies that are working on this kind of stuff. For example, I know an Australian company, which is called Miko, and they're really working on like how to own your own data. And they're like doing a lot of stuff about it. So yeah, you know, the whole privacy thing is a big challenge. Of course, you know, I know within advertising, they're like, I don't know exactly how you say it in English, but they have like this self-control organization or laws, you know, to control everything that is happening. But anyway, you know, I think it's hugely important that there are good frameworks to protect children and youngsters on their privacy, and at least that you own that, you know, that there's a possibility to own your own data. In a way, it's your property. No, it's your property. It's not the property of somebody else. So, and it's like turned around, of course, you know, because we so used in a way already in sharing our data everywhere because, you know, but I think, you know, it's something companies should consider as well. As for me, it fits perfectly in the need of doing good. You know, I mean, with doing good, if you ask young people, Gen Z especially, how they look at companies, or at societies or at governments, the only thing they want to know is what are they doing for the people that I love? You know, it's about creating society value, not only product value. You really have to do good. And, you know, being open about your data policy and you know, being proactive in it, leading the way there, I think companies can make a huge difference there.
Nicely put. And just to give a sort of quote with the book there, so Evert Van Camp, director at Samsung, says Martin's book is a highly recommended read to really understand the most tech-connected generation ever. Indeed. So just before we finish off then, Martin, I say it's been absolutely fascinating talking with you. So just let us know, so in terms of anything coming up in the short-term future for you?
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much about that, Sean. Yes, I'm. Of course, you know, everything can be followed on the website of Trendwolves. You know, it's like trendwolves.com. And I have, as I like, coined the word Zalpha as well. I have a website which is called generationzalpha.com or GenZalpha, where all information is to be found. And I'm, you know, I'm speaking on a lot of places all over the world on the topic. And, you know, I'm always open to discuss things, to corporations, working together. I'm always interested in working together with people.
Well, in that case, that just leaves me to say thank you very much indeed to Martin Leitz, the founder and CEO of Trendwolves and the author of the newly published Generation Zalpha, Connecting with the Next Micro Generation. So, Martin, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Futures Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in the series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.